Welcome to the Fuqua Show, for the stories, the lessons, and the passions of the Team Fuqua community here at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. In today's episode, we will be speaking with Erin Worsham, Executive Director of CASE. Erin Worsham is all about the world of social impact and has been part of the Duke community for nearly 20 years, starting with her days as a Duke undergrad. Since then, her professional experience has spanned over the nonprofit and private sectors, as well as government, including the World Bank, USAID, Booz Allen, and the AEI Brookings Joint Center. Erin's journey has taken her back to Duke, and she currently serves as the Executive Director for the Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship, also known as CASE, here at Fuqua. Outside of work, she enjoys spending time with her husband and two children and enjoys traveling as well as live music. Welcome, Erin.
Thank you so much, Jenna. I'm so glad to be here with you.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add to your intro?
This is like in the realm of fun facts essays that you all have to do, which I love to read and have never actually done for myself. But what else would I like to add? I would say that fun fact about me is that I did my undergraduate work at Duke, as you said, and I was actually a music major at the time and thought I might want to go into a professional music career.
That's fascinating. Did you?
Clearly did not.
Did you play an instrument?
I did. Yes. I played the oboe and the English horn. Really loved it. Was at Duke on a scholarship to play music and was all about it for many years. And now, flash forward, I don't play at all. I listen to a lot of music and I really enjoy music, but I don't play. But maybe one day, maybe I'll get back in the habit.
So that's probably where your love for live music stems from.
Yes. Yes. I love music. I love the emotions and the feelings that music can bring to us. And I find it one of the places, you know, at a concert, really getting into the music where I can just be very present and kind of forget about all the other things in the world. So I'm a big proponent of music and it was a big part of my life.
I am as well. I think during the pandemic, one of the hardest things was no concerts, no live shows, nothing, but we had YouTube.
Those Zoom concerts were not quite the same thing. Absolutely.
No. Well, great. So nearly 20 years here at Duke. I know that you've been in Durham, DC, around the country. But I guess before we dive into that, can you tell us a little more about growing up in New York?
Yes. Yes. So New York born and bred.
What part of New York?
Long Island. So I would say that I had the very stereotypical suburban middle class upbringing, literally like the white picket fence and all of it. My mom was a public school teacher, taught first grade for most of her career. And my dad was an exec in the corporate world, worked in the telecom industry. And, you know, my parents, gosh, like still to this day, then and now, are two of the people that I love and respect and admire more than anybody else on the planet. And they created this, you know, really idyllic kind of, you know, childhood for myself and my two sisters that was just a foundation of love and support and encouragement. And I feel really blessed to look back on that and think about what a wonderful foundation that set for me in my life and what a blessing that is, because not everybody has the advantages and the belief and encouragement in their upbringing. So really grateful for that and had a wonderful childhood in New York, playing all the sports and all the music and doing all the things until I moved down here to North Carolina for college.
And can you tell us more about your two sisters?
Yes. They're awesome. I'm the youngest. I'm the baby, but they probably would tell you that I'm probably the bossiest of the three. I know, Jenna, you're shocked by this. They are 3 years and 6 years older than me. My next oldest sister, the middle sister, is a PhD in psychology. She was actually just down here visiting last weekend with her kids. Her daughter is a senior in high school and is going to be an NC State freshman next year.
So exciting.
Yeah, it's a great, great school and I'm excited for her. And then my oldest sister is 6 years older. She's actually coming into town tonight to visit. She still lives up in New York and she is a librarian working in the elementary school system up in New York.
So a lot of education runs through your family.
Yes, very deeply. We have a lot of educators. And I never thought that I would find myself in that category. It was not my plan, per se. But here I am at Duke all these years. As you said, almost 20 years. I don't know what I feel about that. That's a lot of years.
It's exciting.
I started when I was three. So, you know, it's all good.
And so going back to your childhood and then your time here at Duke, you started playing music as a kid. Can you walk us through which instrument did you start with? How did it grow into such a strong passion?
Yeah. My mom would probably hate me telling the story, but you know, in New York public schools back then, you start playing an instrument in maybe like third grade or something like that. And when the time comes, they say like, what instrument do you want to play? And pretty much everybody picks like the clarinet or the flute or the violin. And my mom said to me at the time, like, well, pick something more interesting, more unique, because you never know. It could help you get into college. She meant it that way, but it's funny to me that it actually worked. So I picked the oboe. I knew my older sister had played for a little while. So picked the oboe and started with that. And from that time and in third grade through college, played very consistently and gave me a lot of opportunities. When I was in high school, I had the chance to travel for the first time with a youth orchestra that I was in. We did a world tour.
Wow. And
so, you know, as a sophomore, between my sophomore and junior year of high school, used that platform of music to get the opportunity to go to India and China and Indonesia, all over the world performing.
That is incredible.
Learning about culture as we went. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, given all your international development work later on, I'm sure that trip sparked some of that interest.
It really did spark that interest for me. And I think set a foundation for me and spark interest, and was such a transformational moment for me to kind of get out of my bubble in the suburbs of New York and see the broader world out there and the differences in cultures and the differences in circumstances. And so in many ways, I think that probably was one of the beginnings of my passion about social impact and wanting to make the world a better place.
So your music career brought you here to Duke as an undergrad. What was 18-year-old Aaron like freshman year when you first step on campus?
It's terrifying to even think about 18-year-old Aaron. Well, you know, music certainly brought me here, but I will say I have to admit that the thing that really brought me here was Duke basketball. I loved Duke basketball. Somehow I didn't know anybody that went to Duke, but I was obsessed and still am obsessed with Duke basketball. And so when I got into Duke, I was very excited to be able to come here. And I remember my dad saying, well, thank goodness it's a good school, because you don't really seem to care about that at all. And I really didn't. I just wanted to come and go to basketball games. So I came here to Duke, and you know, typical freshman, didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. I think I'm still figuring that out in many ways, as we all are. But even then, knew that I wanted to have impact and do something with my life and career that were going to be meaningful for the world. And I didn't know what that looked like, but I ended up majoring in environmental science and policy here at Duke and studying abroad. I lived in Tanzania for about 6 months, my junior year, where I got to study conservation and ecosystems in the rainforests and mountain ranges of Tanzania.
That is so cool. Yeah, that's a very amazing, non-traditional study abroad.
Yes, it was not a Duke program. I decided that, you know, my advice I often give to students is, you know, get outside your comfort zone whenever you can. And it's easy to say, it's hard to do, but at that time in undergrad, so many students were going off and studying abroad. And most of my friends were doing like, you know, Duke in London, Duke in Paris, and they had amazing experiences. But for me, I didn't want to just take my Duke experience and pick it up and put it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so I found and applied for a program through the School for International Training, a school in Vermont. Okay. And so Duke let me do it. It was really an experiential curriculum. And so was able to go to Tanzania to study, as I said, environmental issues and sustainability issues, and actually live with families throughout that time. So I spent probably about a month of that time living with a lower income family in a very rural area of Tanzania. It was a farming community, and helped them farm during the days and learned the language and learned how to understand and have empathy and see the assets that people in a different part of the world with different resources were bringing to their lives and their communities. So amazing experience.
I think living with a host family or locals is so valuable. I did that in the Peace Corps, and not only for language learning, but just, I think, to your earlier comment about like the consequences of what's going on in the world or certain circumstances, and seeing that day to day is very powerful.
Yeah. And it was humbling too. Mm-hmm. I honestly can close my eyes and still picture, you know, all these years later, but picture the scene of I was going out with my host mother and some other women from the community to collect firewood for their homes to cook with. And it, you know, it was hilly terrain. We were in the mountains and it had rained. It was muddy. And here I am in my like expensive American hiking boots. And they are either with, you know, shoddy kind of sandals or barefoot. And I'm slipping and sliding and falling all over myself. I'm carrying like basically a twig back to help with bringing the firewood back. And they have loads of firewood on top of their heads balancing as they're marching up and down this mountain barefoot in the mud. And it was just such a moment for me of, wow, I think that I'm a smart and effective person in the world, but I'm humbled just collecting firewood in this circumstance. And so just gave me an opportunity to see, as I said, the strengths that we all bring, but understanding other people's lives from their perspectives and the strengths and the assets that they bring. And I think that's such an important part of the work that we all do in impact, but truly for any MBAs that are going through a program like Fuqua, to know that we don't have all the answers. And that we can look around us to all of the stakeholders, the community members, the quote, lowest level employees at the biggest companies, and that they have insights to share that might be the things that unlock the solutions and advancements that we need. So just an amazing, amazing experience that was really eye-opening.
Absolutely. So it sounds like your 4 years at Duke were very formative and you wanting to know you want to work in the impact space, still maybe figuring out exactly what kind of sector, what that looked like.
Yeah.
And then after graduation, so here in Durham, time in Tanzania, you moved to DC.
Yes.
I imagine that was quite a jump in, I don't know if culture shock's the right word or.
Yeah, it was definitely different. Yeah. I, the other, you know, transformative thing about Duke was that I met my now husband, my boyfriend at the time here. He was a classmate of mine. And so we decided together to move up to DC. And for me, as you said, I knew I wanted to do impact, but I didn't really know what that meant or what that could look like. My understanding of it at the time was, all right, if I want to do impact, either I'm going to work in like a local community nonprofit, or I'm going to work for government. And so I said, well, I'm going up to DC. What if I kind of do both, right? And so I ended up working at a public policy think tank, so a small nonprofit organization that was working with government around regulatory policy. And I had this path all laid out for myself. Here I am, you know, this degree from Duke. I'm going to move to DC, work at this organization, take 2 or 3 years to embed myself in the work we were doing, learn about policy and do research, et cetera, and then apply to Masters of Public Policy and potentially then work in the government or something like that afterwards. And, you know, I've talked to you, Jenna, about this before and so many other students here, but the best laid plans, right? Like we don't know what's coming next. So we create a plan and we follow it, but we have to be really open to the opportunities and the feedback signals that we get. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've always talked about, you and I, of listening to your energy and what brings you, what lights you up, what are the things that you want to do in your career and seeing opportunities as they come. And so I was in this great job that I loved, but it became clear to me that I didn't actually want to do the policy work and the research, and the Masters of Public Policy didn't feel like the right move for me anymore. Amazing programs, right? But it wasn't right for me. And so I had this incredible boss. His name was Bob Hahn. I still keep up with him, not as often as I'd like to, but still a mentor in my life. And he was somebody that really believed in me. And so he gave me opportunities at that job to do different things. And so I got to do marketing and strategy, and I was helping hire people and onboard them. And at one point he said to me, like, you know, you should think about business school. I looked at him like he was nuts, right? I'm like, here I am, my environmental science and policy degree from Duke. I've just been collecting firewood in the mountains of Tanzania. You know, I want to do good in the world. Like, why in the world would I think about business school? But you can learn a lot by kind of being open to the suggestions and listening to others. And so it became really clear to me after thinking about that a lot, that what I really wanted to do was create impact. And in order for that to happen, we need leaders. We need courageous and collaborative leaders that are going to lead organizations, whether they're nonprofits or government or corporations. But we need those leaders to be effective and to have the skills to create that change and to lead organizations in effective ways. And I knew I didn't know how to do that yet. And so business school made sense for me from that perspective. It was this, you know, pivot point for me. Obviously, this is so relevant to like what I do now at Case. But for me personally, it was this moment where I went from thinking about business school in a pretty uninformed way of like, oh, you only go to business school if you want to be a banker, an investment banker, and you want to make a ton of money. Like nobody that wants to do good things goes to business school. To then realizing, well, actually, there are programs for people like me that want to have impact, and that the skills you learn in business school are so fundamental to leading people, leading organizations, leading movements, and that those skills apply equally at that investment bank as they do at the community nonprofit and everything in between. And so that few years that I was in DC was really instructive for me of the skills that I had, the ones I wanted to develop, and how I could see myself having an impact in the world. And so I suddenly shifted from DC MPP policy route to going to business school out in California and seeing where that was going to take me.
So you decided on Stanford. Mm-hmm. What was it that really drew you there?
I mean, at the time, this is, 2001, 2002, when I was like researching and applying, I went to business school from 2003 to 2005. And so at the time, there weren't as many business schools that were, you know, really thinking about impact and having programming for that. And so it was, my research led me to a smaller group of schools, and Stanford was one of those. I will say Duke was one of those as well. But since I had gone to Duke for undergrad, I wanted to try something different. So Stanford was a great place for me because, you know, of course, it's an amazing institution. But even back then, Duke, Stanford, Harvard, there was a, you know, small set of business schools that really had a focus and a set of programs for students that wanted to use those business and leadership skills to create change. And so I would not say that I was one of the majority of students, especially at that time. There was a small group of us that cared about impact and definitely felt a little different than the rest of, you know, many of my classmates, but it was an amazing 2 years where I learned a ton. I loved my experience. It opened my eyes up to the possibilities of how to have an impact and in what ways. And I still think about the lessons I learned there and still keep in touch with the school and many friends from those days.
Did you narrow in on an impact focus area during that time, or was it more general?
I definitely thought that going into business school, I was like, I have this kind of concept that I want to do impact. And, you know, I like certain issue areas more than others, but business school is really going to be the time that I'm going to take what is somewhat of a broad view and narrow in. I've got 2 years to figure out exactly what it is I want to do. And I, you know, you're smiling a little bit because it's like we all come in thinking that, right? We're going to come out with this crystal clear plan. And
I still have 21 days to make mine.
21 days. We'll do it. No, we don't need to do it. That's the thing. That's what I learned there. But you know, when I was there, instead of narrowing, I actually feel like it did the opposite. Suddenly I was, you know, as I said earlier, my thinking about impact at the time was small nonprofits and government. And so going into business school, recognizing, and the field has progressed much further than from then, but even then, the, you know, nonprofit and for-profit models for impact and, you know, the different avenues to achieve impact. So it almost opened my eyes to so many more paths, which was amazing, but not what I was expecting. So incredible, but still came out with a lot of pathways to explore and am continuing to explore those as I go. Maybe one day I'll get to that super focused vision that I had all those years ago, but I don't think so. I think I'm just going to keep exploring and learning what's new.
That's great. And you mentioned you had this smaller group of students that were also impact focused. What was it like being part of that group versus maybe the broader bankers, consultants, marketing?
And it was amazing. It was amazing to have a cohort.
About how big were you, the cohort?
you know, it always, people ask me how big the cohort is here at Case, right? It's hard to answer that because it depends on how you define the cohort. But, you know, in my class, if I think about the very like impact driven people like me that were at business school for impact, we're going to be doing impact. Dozen, 15 maybe. And then of course there were, you know, lots of others that cared about issues, but it was relatively small, but very important to have that kind of safe space. Mm. You know, we talk a lot these days about belonging and diversity. And so for me, being a woman in business school and being focused on impact, I was not the norm. And so having the exposure to students that thought really differently than I did and had very different backgrounds and were going to do very different things was incredibly important and fun. Mm. But also having that group to come back to that got me and I got them and was kind of a safe space was really important. And I think a lot about my time in business school informs some of the work that we do at Case. And when we think about our student programs, I mean, we talked to you all about that we focus on helping our students build competencies, build the skill sets, build connections for their networking and career paths, but also build community. And I think that community part is so important to be that support system that is the safe space where you can be vulnerable and where you can help support each other, not just while you're in business school, but for the decades and decades afterwards when you're going through your career. And so it was really important to me to have that community, and it remains a really important part of my life.
Well, thank you to you and your team, because I feel like Case has been that community for me here, even though I'm not a Case fellow, but just being part of Case mm-hmm. I3 in different areas. Coming from the Peace Corps, I was like, who will I be friends with in business school? Mm-hmm. It was a bit intimidating.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think back to your comment about community and then also recognizing that the skill set we do have does bring value to organizations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Oh, can we say that again? Like, you know, for the people in the back, you're coming from a Peace Corps background, but those skills, like you, so many students with quote non-traditional backgrounds come into business school like I did with a total imposter syndrome. How did I get to this business school? I worked at a nonprofit for a few years. Like, what am I bringing to these conversations? And sitting in classes besides, you know, classmates that had done consulting for years. And so they had all of these experiences, like multiple Fortune 500 clients that they were referencing, or, you know, I'll never forget sitting in core accounting, not understanding at all the language that was being spoken to me. And the guy sitting next to me just, you know, it seemed so easy for him. And then I come to find out about halfway through the semester that he was a CPA.
I should not have been in that class.
Exactly. He shouldn't have placed out of that class, but of course it was easy for him, right? So that imposter syndrome for those of us that have those less traditional backgrounds coming into business school is real. And one of my favorite things to do is to work with students to say, your experience is absolutely relevant and so critical to the conversations we're having here and to the business environment. We just have to translate it in a different way. And I would argue that someone like you, Jenna, that's coming from a Peace Corps background, the experiences you've had and the skills that you have to be adaptive and resilient and to work across cultures and sectors, those are the things that are actually really hard to learn.
You
can learn accounting and finance and strategy. You can learn those frameworks. But what we deem in society as softer skills, I think are actually the really hard skills. And so I suffer from imposter syndrome. We all do, but I love to play that role for students to kind of help them see what the unique things they're bringing into the conversation.
I think that's so valuable, because also thinking back to your boss that you mentioned, he was like, hey, what about the MBA? Sometimes you need someone that's a bit removed from the voices we have in our head to be like, hey, have
Absolutely.
You thought about this?
Absolutely. And it always makes me reflect on, or here in a school of management, a school of leadership, like what kind of leader do we each want to be? And I think back to that boss, so Bob, who encouraged me to think about business school and then encouraged me to apply and then wrote one of my recommendation letters. And I, you know, again, another moment, like I can close my eyes and literally picture this of getting the acceptance letter to Stanford. And I went into work the next day and I wrote a note to him thanking him for his encouragement and for serving as a reference letter and said, like, you know, I got in. And I put that note in his like mail pile. so old school. Like, we actually had mail that we would open, right? I put in his mail pile. He wasn't in yet. And then I went to my office down the hall and was working away and heard him come in later, not really thinking about it. And I hear from down the hall very loudly, "Yes, Aaron!" And then the like pitter patter of somebody running down the hallway to my office and like just busting into my office, so excited. So to have somebody that as a mentor and as a manager believed so much in me and my potential and celebrated my success in like such an exuberant way. He just wanted me to succeed and he believed that I could and he wanted to empower that. It wasn't going to help him. It wasn't going to help our group, you know, but just that belief and that empowerment of somebody. And I, you know, I think about that as an example of the kind of leader that I try to be and I want to be. And I think we should all be of how do we take the ego and the selfishness out and be the kind of leader that wants the people that are working for us or that we're partnering with to succeed, to have their potential unlocked and put them on a path to something that's even bigger and greater. For me, that's what being a leader is about. And I love that I've had those experiences with people to sort of model that for me. And I hope I do that for the people that I manage and have managed throughout the years. But it's, you know, business school is a powerful place to really think about that. What kind of leader do we want to be and how could we make that happen?
Thank you so much for sharing that. The story that you just shared about the boss reminds me of when I was applying to Fuqua. My boss at the time wrote a letter of recommendation and I was living in Lima, Peru at the time. And so I walk into her office and I told her I got an interview and she just like, I don't know, you could have told her she won like $1 million. She like went into the street, bought everyone ice cream. I'm like, she knows it's just an interview, yeah. Right? Like,
she knows I didn't get the yes yet.
Right? I'm not just in interview. Yet. And she's like, I know, but it's so exciting.
You want people that are going to celebrate you and lift you up and empower you to be a better version of yourself. And for me, that's leadership.
Absolutely. And so fast forward a few years, you move back to DC. Mm-hmm. Again, we're working, was it more government focused or was it private sector?
Well, I moved back to DC this summer in between my first and second years of business school and did an internship at the World Bank. And then I moved back again after I graduated, started with the U.S. Agency for International Development. When I was there, I was doing public-private partnerships work. Mm-hmm. So working with the government, but helping support partnerships with corporations and local communities in USAID's areas of development interest.
So you talk a lot about both in this interview as well as the class I've had the opportunity to work with you and just the value of partnerships. What do you think is something that all these different sectors need to learn from each other? Like, what does the nonprofit bring that the private sector needs, vice versa?
Yeah, that's such a good question. You've heard me talk before about tri-sector leadership. And it's funny because we had our board meeting, our case board meeting earlier this week, and that came up from the board members, you know, this concept of tri-sector leadership and how important it is. I, you know, you're going to get me on a soapbox for a second, but we live in such challenging times, right? The polycrisis world. Of course, we've been through a pandemic recently, but crises around economic inequality and racial injustice and climate change. There's so many things that need to be corrected. We need to be able to imagine and work towards a different and better future. And so when I think about the sectors, nonprofit, social sector, the private sector, the public sector, we can't do that work without all of those sectors. It is just not going to happen with one sector alone. There's just no way. And so for me, the critical part about solving social and environmental problems is really about how do we bring the assets and the leverage points of each of those sectors together. And so like tactically to answer your question, it very much depends on the organizations, but as a stereotype, generally, I see the nonprofit sector as having closer connections to the communities, to understanding the needs and desires and solutions that communities have to solve the problems that they experience. And that community rootedness and understanding is so critical to solving social and environmental problems. I see the public sector as bringing scale. And man, we need that when we're talking about climate change and racial, you know, systemic racial injustice. And then the private sector brings capital, but also brings, you know, the resources of technology and efficient operational practices, et cetera. So sometimes I hear students kind of playing the sectors against each other. Like, I think I need to go to the private sector because it's where I'm going to go to learn, you know, XYZ skill. And I'm like, any of those sectors, you can learn those things if you've got a great organization and a great leader you're working for. But most importantly, we want all of those sectors working towards the change we seek.
Absolutely. I love that term, trisector leadership. Mm-hmm. I feel like when I would explain those things, it was more like a word vomit. So now I have a clear and concise way to say that.
I've written about it. We've got things that, you know, we can share to give you the words.
And so I guess fast forwarding a little bit, you're back on Duke's campus here at Case. How did that all come to be? I know that you originally started as an associate director. Is that correct? And then
I think so. It's been a long time, but I'm pretty sure. Yes.
Moved up from there.
Yeah. I never in a million years thought, you know, I talked a little bit about my career. So I started in the nonprofit social sector, then did government, quasi-government work, then private sector. I did consulting for a number of years, but where I was consulting with government and nonprofit clients. So, you know, kind of checked all the boxes. I thought, okay, I've done every sector. But then I was like, oh, higher ed, there's one I haven't done. Wasn't expecting to check that box too. But the funny story is that I was consulting in DC at the time and was asked to come back to Fuqua as, you know, Duke alum working in impact consulting. And so was asked by MBA students at that time to come and speak on a panel about social sector, social impact consulting at a conference, which is now the SBSI conference. It wasn't called that at the time.
The conference that you moderated last month.
Yes, it is strange to think about
that.
Yes, but many years ago was on the panel. And I knew that I was ready to move on from consulting at that point. And so while I was here, I was like, hey, I'm a Duke alum. Like, let me talk to the people here on campus that might be able to give me advice about career path. And one of the people I spoke with was Matt Nash, who's my predecessor as executive director of CASE. And for anybody that knows Matt, he's the most generous human being, giving up his time and his advice and his connections. And so he sat down with me and we formed a connection and then continued to, you know, keep in touch with each other. And I don't know, maybe a few months later or something along those lines, he said, well, you know, we're actually going to be hiring somebody here. Would you ever think about it? And it literally had not occurred to me. But the more I thought about it and thought about the you know, equivalent staff and faculty at Stanford when I was there, how critical they were. They were an anchor for me when I was in business school and trying to figure out how I fit and where my career was going to go. But it was just so important that I had that support system and I learned so much from them. And so when Matt mentioned it, I really thought about, wow, like I could do that for other people. How cool is that? And then with CASE, not only do we get to work with the students, but we have the chance to try to build practice. So creating thought leadership and tools and trainings for impact professionals out in the world, impact investors, social entrepreneurs, corporate impact leaders. And so to be able to couple working with the students here at Fuqua and playing that role that others had played for me of helping me evolve and transform and grow and blossom. And also getting to work with like my rock stars, like the people I at conferences sometimes. And I'm like, oh my God, is that so-and-so? Like I'm just a geek about social impact. So having the chance to work with people that are out there in the world doing the really hard work day in and day out of trying to solve social problems and to get to learn from them and with them and try to help accelerate their work. I mean, how do you say no to that? And then almost 15 years later, I'm still saying yes.
That's incredible. Yeah. So I think you touched on this a little bit in your last answer, but what keeps you at CASE?
I mean, part of it is that I can't believe it's been so long. Thanks to you students, you keep it fresh for us, right? Every year it's a new group of students coming in and every 2 years it's completely new. So it feels like a job that reinvents itself over and over and over again. And so for me, my longest job before this one was probably when I was in consulting. It was about almost three and a half years, a little less than that. So a little over 3 years. And now it's been almost 15 here. So I am somebody that likes to be challenged, likes to do new things, wants to, you know, keep it moving, new problems to solve, new challenges to meet. And I feel like this job reinvents itself constantly. And so I think I've had, you know, 25 jobs in the time I've been here, not by title, but in terms of the work I do. And it's something I talk to students about all the time of like, you don't have to switch jobs every 2 years. It seems like that's the pattern now. You don't have to do that. There's actually real advantage to staying within one organization and knowing the stakeholders and the power structures and how to get things done. And if you can do that in a way where you actually feel like you're being challenged all the time and having new ways to learn and grow, what a blessing. So yeah, 15 years. And then how do I, you know, kind of keep myself grounded in that? Just being, you know, we talk a lot about mission moments, celebrating mission moments in impact work. Any organization, you need to do that to keep yourself driving towards the goal. Change is hard. It takes a long time. And so celebrating those mission moments to remind yourself of the work you're doing. And so for me, those mission moments are the individual conversations I'll have with students where I like almost literally can see the light bulb turn on, whether it's a concept around social innovation or thinking about their own career path. That keeps me going. It's our alumni. Just in the last week, I've had the chance to sit down with alums, you know, an alum leading ESG for a corporation with 25,000 employees, an alum that's launching a new impact investment fund to invest in women and local African entrepreneurs in East Africa, an alum that is the CEO of an organization that just was awarded $7 billion from the federal government.
Wow.
To try to help ensure a just transition, that the benefits of green technologies are going to benefit lower income populations here in the US. So getting to see, you know, the one-on-one connection with the students and then the ripple effects that that has on impact around the world. And the same thing on the practitioner side. I talked with an entrepreneur from Ghana last week who was talking about some of the tools that we've developed at CASE, and one in particular around trying to raise impact investment capital. And he said that he had done a pitch, raising money for his company, done a pitch to a funder and gotten a resounding no, and then used our tools, redid his pitch deck, thought differently about his impact evidence and the financial model, went back to that same funder, same business model, same entrepreneur, and got a yes.
Wow.
And went on to raise $18 million in that round. And, you know, the impact that he's now able to have on smallholder farmers in Ghana with his company. So having those moments where you can, you know, the days are long in any job that we're in. There's a lot of meetings, a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of frustrations and setbacks, but to be able to hold yourself grounded to the purpose of what you're doing and to seek out and celebrate those examples when they pop up. We all need to do that. And so I'm trying to be better about doing that for myself and my team to celebrate those and keep the fight going.
And building off that, to create a better future, we know it takes time, 10 years, 20 years longer. So looking back at how CASE was started by Greg Dease, the late Greg Dease, what do you think he would say now if he saw where CASE was today?
Ooh, it's such a good question. You know, and for the listeners that don't know, Greg Dease was our founder at CASE and really one of the luminaries in the field. He's called the founder of social entrepreneurship education, really was one of the people that sort of named and built the field of social entrepreneurship. He passed away 10 years ago this past December. So I think about him often and hope that we are leading CASE in a way that would make him really proud. And I think we are. I think that he would look at the work that we've done and be proud that it's been, you know, thousands of MBA students that we have worked with and the alumni examples I gave of the impact that they're having. And for him to know that he started that. And our practitioner work, you know, we have a Coursera course on impact management and measurement for the SDGs that over 30,000 learners have participated in. We've had millions of downloads of our resources on our website, like the reach, the breadth.
And from around the world.
Yeah, it's really astounding what the team has been able to do. And I think he would be really proud of that, of the scale, the reach of it, but also the depth of the experience for our students and the potential that I hope we unlock in students and practitioners out in the world, and the impact that that will result in. So I hope he'd be proud. I really do. I really do hope he'd be proud. I also imagine he'd be impatient, because I know I am, that we want to do more and faster.
So speaking of the future, what's on the horizon? Personally, any personal goals, professional goals?
Mm, gosh, so many things on the horizon. Generally, I would say from the case perspective, we want to do more. We want to continue to push Case and Fuqua and Duke to lead in the social impact space, and to ensure that we are providing the best curriculum and trainings and programming to train the next generation of talent, MBAs or students all across this university, and really driving practice in the field. I want Case and Fuqua and Duke to continue to be on the cutting edge of that work, driving the conversation. And, you know, to reflect back on my own career, how much that conversation has changed. I mean, you know, at the beginning of my career, it was, I guess, a community nonprofit or maybe government. Now, B Corporations, impact investing, corporate impact. It's incredible how much the field of social impact has evolved, and there is more to do. And so I'm excited for us to continue to lead in those conversations. And then personally, fired up to help drive that work. And, you know, very tangibly also focused on raising two small human beings that I hope are going to be part of the solutions. So on a personal level and on a professional level, trying to set the stage for people that are going to reimagine the systems that we have now and help create an economy and a world in which everyone gets to thrive.
Well, I think they have a great role model to do that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And to wrap up, we are going to try something new on the Fuqua show. We're doing 5 rapid fire questions. So I will ask you a question and ask that you respond in a few words or a sentence.
Okay. I do this to people all the time. We call them lightning rounds when I do them. And they're so fun to ask the questions. This is the first time I'm on the other end, and it doesn't feel as fun to me. I'm a little terrified.
Hopefully it won't be too bad.
Okay.
First one, if you could become an expert in another field of work, what would it be?
I would probably say technology, AI. So many questions around how we're going to use some of the data and AI tools for good and not have unintended harm.
Great. Next one, what do you think is the most important skill that MBAs should graduate with?
Curiosity.
What is your favorite spot in Durham?
There's so many good spots in Durham. The Durham Bulls Stadium.
Big baseball fan?
I grew up a Mets fan, so yes, but I love going to the Bulls, but also just such a good community feel there. It's so fun, and community and good baseball all wrapped up in one, and good beers and good food. So it's a happy place for
Can't
me.
Can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Well, leads us to our next question. Where's your go-to place when you want to relax?
I would say home. I love nothing more than curling up on the couch, ideally with my husband and my 2 kids around, just enjoying being together.
And the last one, what is the best piece of advice that you would give to our listeners?
I think I'm going to steal somebody else's advice and pass it on. A colleague and a mentor and a friend, Lorraine Orr, who is actually just here on campus this week. She's the COO of the Boys and Girls Clubs of America. And she said to me, I had asked her this question like years ago of what's the piece of advice that sticks the most with you. And what she said was, you know, I don't have the words exactly right, but figure out how you can move away from success to significance. And that's always resonated with me so deeply, especially in a business school environment where when we think about success, we think about promotions and salaries and, you know, brand names and, you know, materialistic things and you know, the things we celebrate in a capitalist culture as success, I think are really different than what leading a life of significance is all about. And so I try to live by that. But my advice for others is to think about the significance that you want to have, the legacy you want to have. Why are you here? How are you going to help others? How are you going to make the world a better place? How are you going to have an impact on the individuals around you and on the community at large? And shift from thinking about success to significance.
Well, Erin, thank you so much for being here today and taking the time. We know you have a very busy schedule, and we wish you and Case the best.
Thank you so much, Jenna. This has been so fun, and excited to be part of this amazing Fuqua show. So thank you so much for having me.